The world has tried many ways to find God and understand him, and that search begins at a whole variety of starting points. For some, the way forward is through the efforts and applications of pure reason, abstract thought based on first principles of philosophical inquiry. They go for the big concepts. Working from general principles, they grope their way towards God and an understanding of who God is. These are the intellectual activities that have occupied the minds of great thinkers and theologians over the centuries. For example, they think like this. Everything has a cause, so there must be a first cause that is the cause of everything. And that first cause is God. And since God, by definition, needs no cause, well, that's it, we're sorted. Or they argue, if we define God as being that than which nothing greater can be conceived, and if it is greater to exist than not to exist, then therefore God must exist. Again, And we shake our heads and wonder where the great minds learn to play intellectual hunt the lady. Aquinas, Anselm, Immanuel Kant, the metaphysics and the sleight of hand, they almost had us bamboozled into belief. The preoccupations of the men and women who sought by reasoning to find God. Nice try, but no cigar. Others have begun with nature and perceived the sense of design that they've found there, and they move from the order within it all to conclusions about the power and the energy behind that order. They see the impulse of life forces, the driving thrust of nature, and within the structures and coherence of creation, they detect the hand of the Creator, the great watchmaker. You know, they say, you find a watch on the beach ticking in perfect order. It couldn't just have happened. Someone must have made it, is the conclusion. The watchmaker above and beyond the universe he made. They discover a sense of direction, a design so intricate that even the random factors can be contained within the direction, the drive, a design so complex and perfect that even the rogue factors can be absorbed. And they conclude from their analysis and their sense of wonder, the reality of God and something of his nature. Nature's capriciousness, viciousness, and its deadly diseases and destructive power, notwithstanding. Now, while these avenues of exploration are fascinating and stimulating approaches to the mystery of God, they are not at all the way in which the Bible teaches us about him. For it comes by way of what the experts call the scandal of particularity. The scandal of particularity. Which means basically this, God reveals himself not in the abstract generalities of intellectual endeavour, nor even in the somewhat ambiguous character of the natural world, but, shock horror, through the experience of particular people. The ancient tale of a man called Adam shows us what disobedience is and what its price will be. The courageous journey of a man called Abraham teaches us what faith is, as we watch him going out, not knowing where he was going, but in response to the call of God, he goes. At a special place, to Moses, a particular leader of a specially chosen people, the law of God is given, his will revealed. Through an insignificant little nation, the nobody's children of the ancient Near East, Israel, the nowhere men and women, God chooses to tell us who he is, what he is like, and what he wants from us. We feel the shock of this method of revelation, nicely characterised by the hilarious story of Naaman, the great general, who was told he must bathe in the River Jordan in order to be healed from his leprosy. And he rebels against this crazy notion that this muddy little burn, this Jordan River, should matter. Here of all places? You cannot be serious. We have real rivers where I come from, he says. But that's the deal. This is the crazy package offered to us. Israel, of all people, a light to the nations. Experience indicates that it might not have been a very inspired choice. On first and second and third appearances, they prove unreliable, perverse. Again and again, they go, to use the Bible's evocative language, they go whoring after false gods. They are frequently and stubbornly resistant to spiritual values, and obtuse to the point of bovine stupidity when it comes to learning the ways of God. And there is worse to come, much worse. yet miracle of miracles. Through the learning experience of this pilgrim people, their mistakes, their failures of nerve, their endless derelictions, their exile, their return, their pain and their suffering, we find wonderful hooks on which to hang our understanding of God. Their story, a parable full of meaning. Their songs, their poetry, their prophets and their journey. Which is why the many attempts throughout history to douse the light, to destroy the people, represent an attack on God's purposes. Whether history likes it or not, God has presented us with the scandal of particularity. In one sense, it makes no sense, yet it works. Their story and their stumblings reveal the heart of God. It's all filtered down to this place, this people. And his greatest act of self-revelation, it too will find its locus within their history and be rooted and grounded in their geography. The conduit of his ultimate final self-disclosure is this problem people, called to be a light to the nations, but so often fumbling and faithless and liable in their spiritual arrogance and moral weakness to obscure the light. And then, at a particular place, at a particular time, the Christ is born of a particular woman. And here, located in the life of Jesus of Nazareth, a real man from some one-horse town in northern Israel, located in his life is the way, the truth, and the life, the Word made flesh and come among us. And in the context of this flawed and often and disappointing delinquent people, the true light of the world is come. And what happens? His own people, this chosen people, they don't want to know. They reject his coming to them and prefer to stick with their rigid legalism and reassuring clutter of ecclesiastical small print. Impossibly worse still, and here the scandal of particularity truly becomes unbearable. On a particular day, at an identifiable place, involving specific named people, they crucify the Son of God in all the blood, shame and savagery that is Calvary. Too much, people said, this cannot be borne. Give us back our generalities and our concepts and our abstractions. Let us play again our harmless games of intellectual chess, where no one dies. This is too much to bear. The idea that it could all hang on Jesus of Nazareth, that truth and love and humanity and forgiveness. That all of these things, truth, love, humanity and forgiveness, could have been summed up, gathered up in his life, only to be tortured, beaten and battered and betrayed at that place on that Friday at 3 o'clock. It gets that specific, that focused, that real, that particular. And suddenly the scandal of particularity shatters our comfortable notions of religion. No wonder people wanted to hurry away back to the safety of their intellectual, cozy, philosophical conundrums where nothing is earthed, nothing is too direct, nothing hurts. This outrageous Christian way comes right up to our life, right into our face, looks us in the eye and wants to know what we think about this. Not about the vague religious notions of generalized abstraction, but about this man. What do we think about this particular man?